The Beer Hall Pooch. About a quarter to nine on the evening of November 8, 1923, after Carr had been speaking for half an hour to some 3,000 thirsty burghers, seated at rough-hewn tables and quaffing their beer out of stone mugs in the Bavarian fashion, SA troops surrounded the Burger Broikeller, and Hitler pushed forward into the hall. While some of his men were mounting a machine gun in the entrance, Hitler jumped up on a table, and to attract attention, fired a revolver shot toward the ceiling. Carr paused in his discourse. The audience turned around to see what was the cause of the disturbance. Hitler, with the help of Hess and of Ulrich Graf, the former butcher, amateur wrestler and brawler, and now the leader's bodyguard, made his way to the platform. A police major tried to stop him, but Hitler pointed his pistol at him and pushed on. Carr, according to one eyewitness, had now become pale and confused. He stepped back from the rostrum, and Hitler took his place. "The National Revolution has begun," Hitler shouted. "This building is occupied by 600 heavily armed men. No one may leave the hall. Unless there is immediate quiet, I shall have a machine gun posted in the gallery. The Bavarian and Reich governments have been removed, and a provisional national government formed. The barracks of the Reichswehr and police are occupied. The army and the police are marching on the city under the swastika banner." This last was false. It was pure bluff. But in the confusion, no one knew for sure. Hitler's revolver was real. It had gone off. The stormtroopers with their rifles and machine guns were real. Hitler now ordered Carr, Loso, and Zeisser to follow him to a nearby private room off stage. Prodded by stormtroopers, the three highest officials of Bavaria did Hitler's bidding while the crowd looked on in amazement. But with growing resentment, too. Many businessmen still regarded Hitler as something of an upstart. One of them shouted to the police, "Don't be cowards as in 1918. Shoot!" But the police, with their own chiefs so docile and the SA taking over the hall, did not budge. Hitler had arranged for a Nazi spy at police headquarters, Wilhelm Frick, to telephone the police on duty at the beer hall not to interfere but merely to report. The crowd began to grow so sullen that Goering felt it necessary to step to the rostrum and quiet them. "There is nothing to fear," he cried. "We have the friendliest intentions. For that matter, you've no cause to grumble. You've got your beer." And he informed them that in the next room, a new government was being formed. It was, at the point of Adolf Hitler's revolver. Once he had herded his prisoners into the adjoining room, Hitler told them, "No one leaves this room alive without my permission." He then informed them they would all have key jobs, either in the Bavarian government or in the Reich government, which he was forming with Ludendorff. With Ludendorff? Earlier in the evening, Hitler had dispatched Scheubner Richter to Ludwigshöhe to fetch the renowned general, who knew nothing of the Nazi conspiracy, to the beer house at once. The three prisoners at first refused even to speak to Hitler. He continued to harangue them. Each of them must join him in proclaiming the revolution and the new governments. Each must take the post he, Hitler, assigned them, or he has no right to exist. Carr was to be the regent of Bavaria, Loso, minister of the National Army, Zeisser, minister of the Reich Police. None of the three was impressed at the prospect of such high office. They did not answer. Their continued silence unnerved Hitler. Finally, he waved his gun at them. "I have 4 shots in my pistol, 3 for my collaborators if they abandon me. The last bullet for myself." Pointing the weapon to his forehead, he cried, "If I am not victorious by tomorrow afternoon, I shall be a dead man." Carr was not a very bright individual, but he had physical courage. "Herr Hitler," he answered, "you can have me shot or shoot me yourself. Whether I die or not is no matter." Zeisser also spoke up. He reproached Hitler for breaking his word of honor not to make a putsch against the police. "Yes, I did," Hitler replied. "Forgive me, but I had to for the sake of the fatherland." General von Loso disdainfully maintained silence, but when Carr started to whisper to him, Hitler snapped, "Halt! No talking without my permission." He was getting nowhere with his own talk. Not one of the three men who held the power of the Bavarian state in their hands had agreed to join him, even at pistol point. The putsch wasn't going according to plan. Then Hitler acted on a sudden impulse. Without a further word, He dashed back into the hall, mounted the tribune, faced the sullen crowd, and announced that the members of the triumvirate in the next room had joined him in forming a new national government. "The Bavarian ministry," he shouted, "is removed. The government of the November criminals and the Reich president are declared to be removed. A new national government will be named this very day here in Munich. A German national army will be formed immediately. I propose that, until accounts have been finally settled with the November criminals, the direction of policy in the national government be taken over by me. Ludendorff will take over the leadership of the German National Army. The task of the provisional German National Government is to organize the march on that sinful Babel, Berlin, and save the German people. Tomorrow we'll find either a national government in Germany or us dead." Not for the first time, and certainly not for the last, Hitler had told a masterful lie, and it worked. When the gathering heard that Kahr, General von Lossow, and Police Chief von Zeisser had joined Hitler, its mood abruptly changed. There were loud cheers, and the sound of them impressed the three men still locked up in the little side room. Scheubner Richter now produced General Ludendorff as if out of a hat. The war hero was furious with Hitler for pulling such a complete surprise on him, and when, once closeted in the side room, he learned that the former corporal and not he was to be the dictator of Germany, his resentment was compounded. He spoke scarcely a word to the brash young man. But Hitler did not mind, so long as Ludendorff lent his famous name to the desperate undertaking and won over the three recalcitrant Bavarian leaders who thus far had failed to respond to his own exhortations and threats. This Ludendorff proceeded to do. It was now a question of a great national cause, he said, and he advised the gentlemen to cooperate. Awed by the attention of the generalissimo, the trio appeared to give in, though later Lossow denied that he had agreed to place himself under Ludendorff's command. For a few minutes Kahr fussed over the question of restoring the Wittelsbach monarchy, which was so dear to him. Finally, he said he would cooperate as the king's deputy. Ludendorff's timely arrival had saved Hitler. Overjoyed at this lucky break, he led the others back to the platform, where each made a brief speech and swore loyalty to each other and to the new regime. The crowd leaped on chairs and tables in a delirium of enthusiasm. Hitler beamed with joy. "He had a childlike, frank expression of happiness that I shall never forget," an eminent historian who was present later declared. Again mounting the rostrum, Hitler spoke his final word to the gathering. "I want now to fulfill the vow which I made to myself 5 years ago when I was a blind cripple in the military hospital. To know neither rest nor peace until the November criminals had been overthrown, until on the ruins of the wretched Germany of today there should have arisen once more a Germany of power and greatness, of freedom and splendor." This meeting began to break up. At the exits, Hess, aided by stormtroopers, detained a number of Bavarian cabinet members and other notables who were trying to slip out with the throng. Hitler kept his eye on Kahr, Lossow, and Zeisser. Then news came of a clash between stormtroopers of one of the fighting leagues, the Bund Oberland, and regular troops at the army engineers' barracks. Hitler decided to drive to the scene and settle the matter personally, leaving the beer hall in charge of Ludendorff. This turned out to be a fatal error. Lossow was the first to slip away. He informed Ludendorff that he must hurry to his office at army headquarters to give the necessary orders. When Scheubner Richter objected, Ludendorff rejoined stiffly, "I forbid you to doubt the word of a German officer." Kahr and Zeisser vanished too. Hitler, in high spirits, returned to the Bürgerbräu to find that the birds had flown the coop. This was the first blow of the evening, and it stunned him. He had confidently expected to find his ministers busy at their new tasks while Ludendorff and Lossow worked out plans for the march on Berlin. But almost nothing was being done. Not even Munich was being occupied by the revolutionary forces. Röhm, at the head of a detachment of stormtroopers from another fighting league, the Reichskriegsflagge, had seized army headquarters at the War Ministry in the Schönfeldstrasse, but no other strategic centers were occupied, not even the telegraph office, over whose wires news of the coup went out to Berlin, and orders came back, from General von Seeckt to the army in Bavaria, to suppress the putsch. Though there were some defections among the junior officers and some of the troops, whose sympathies were with Hitler and Röhm, the higher officers, led by General von Danner, commander of the Munich garrison, not only were prepared to carry out Zeicht's command, but were bitterly resentful of the treatment meted out to General von Lossow. In the army's code, a civilian who pointed a revolver at a general deserved to be smitten by an officer's sidearms. From headquarters at the 19th Infantry Barracks, where Lossow had joined Danner, messages went out to outlying garrisons to rush reinforcements to the city. By dawn, regular army troops had drawn a cordon around Röhm's forces in the War Ministry. Before this action, Hitler and Ludendorff joined Röhm at the ministry for a time to take stock of the situation. Röhm was shocked to find that no one besides himself had taken military action and occupied the key centers. Hitler tried desperately to re-establish contact with Lossow, Kahr, and Zeisser. Messengers were dispatched to the 19th Infantry Barracks in the name of Ludendorff, but they did not return. Perner, the former Munich police chief and now one of Hitler's supporters, was sent with Major Hünlein and a band of the SA troopers to occupy police headquarters. They were promptly arrested there. And what of Gustav von Kahr, the head of the Bavarian government? After leaving the Bürgerbräukeller, he had quickly recovered his senses and his courage. Not wishing to take any more chances on being made a prisoner of Hitler and his rowdies, Kahr moved the government to Regensburg. But not before he had ordered placards posted throughout Munich carrying the following proclamation. The deception and perfidy of ambitious comrades have converted a demonstration in the interests of national reawakening into a scene of disgusting violence. The declarations extorted from myself, General von Lossow, and Colonel Zeisser at the point of the revolver are null and void. The National Socialist German Workers' Party, as well as the Fighting League's Oberland and Reichskriegsflagge, are dissolved. Von Kahr, General State Commissioner. The triumph, which earlier in the evening had seemed to Hitler so near and so easily won, was rapidly fading with the night. The basis for a successful political revolution on which he had always insisted, the support of existing institutions such as the army, the police, the political group in power, was now crumbling. Not even Ludendorff's magic name, it was now clear, had won over the armed forces of the state. Hitler suggested that perhaps the situation could be retrieved if he and the general withdrew to the countryside near Rosenheim and rallied the peasants behind the armed bands for an assault on Munich. But Ludendorff promptly rejected the idea. Or perhaps there was another way out, which at least would avert disaster. On first hearing of the putsch, Crown Prince Ruprecht, a bitter personal enemy of Ludendorff, had issued a brief statement calling for its prompt suppression. Now, Hitler decided to appeal to the prince to intercede with Lossow and Kahr and obtain an honorable, peaceful settlement. A Lieutenant Neunzert, a friend of Hitler and of Ruprecht, was hurried off at dawn to the Wittelsbach Castle near Berchtesgaden on the delicate mission. Unable to find an automobile, he had to wait for a train and did not arrive at his destination until noon, at which hour events were taking a turn not foreseen by Hitler, nor dreamt of as possible by Ludendorff. Hitler had planned a putsch, not a civil war. Despite his feverish state of excitement, he was in sufficient control of himself to realize that he lacked the strength to overcome the police and the army. He had wanted to make a revolution with the armed forces, not against them. Bloodthirsty though he had been in his recent speeches and during the hours he held the Bavarian triumvirs at gunpoint, he shrank from the idea of men united in their hatred of the Republic shedding the blood of each other. So did Ludendorff. He would, as he had told his wife, string up President Ebert and company and gladly watch them dangle from the gallows. But he did not wish to kill policemen and soldiers who, in Munich at least, believed with him in the national counter-revolution. To the wavering young Nazi leader, Ludendorff now proposed a plan of his own that might still bring them victory and yet avoid bloodshed. German soldiers, even German police, who were mostly ex-soldiers, would never dare, he was sure, to fire on the legendary commander who had led them to great victories on both the Eastern and the Western fronts. He and Hitler would march with their followers to the center of the city and take it over. Not only would the police and the army not dare to oppose him, he was certain, they would join him and fight under his orders. Though somewhat skeptical, Hitler agreed. There seemed no other way out. The Crown Prince, he noted, had not replied to his plea for mediation. Toward 11 o'clock on the morning of November 9th, the anniversary of the proclamation of the German Republic, Hitler and Ludendorff led a column of some 3,000 stormtroopers out of the gardens of the Bürgerbräukeller and headed for the center of Munich. Beside them in the front rank marched Göring, commander of the SA, Scheubner-Richter, Rosenberg, Ulrich Graf, Hitler's bodyguard, and half a dozen other Nazi officials and leaders of the Kampfbund. A swastika flag and a banner of the Bund Oberland were unfurled at the head of the column. Not far behind the first ranks, a truck chugged along, loaded with machine guns and machine gunners. The stormtroopers carried carbines slung over their shoulders, some with fixed bayonets. Hitler brandished his revolver. Not a very formidable armed force, but Ludendorff, who had commanded millions of Germany's finest troops, apparently thought it sufficient for his purposes. A few hundred yards north of the beer cellar, the rebels met their first obstacle. On the Ludwig Bridge, which leads over the River Isar toward the center of the city, stood a detachment of armed police barring the route. Göring sprang forward and, addressing the police commander, threatened to shoot a number of hostages he said he had in the rear of his column if the police fired on his men. During the night, Hess and others had rounded up a number of hostages, including two cabinet members, for just such a contingency. Whether Göring was bluffing or not, the police commander apparently believed he was not, and let the column file over the bridge unmolested. At the Marienplatz, the Nazi column encountered a large crowd which was listening to an exhortation of Julius Streicher, the Jew-baiter from Nuremberg, who had rushed to Munich at the first news of the putsch. Not wishing to be left out of the revolution, he cut short his speech and joined the rebels, jumping into step immediately behind Hitler. Shortly after noon, the marchers neared their objective, the War Ministry, where Röhm and his stormtroopers were surrounded by soldiers of the Reichswehr. Neither besiegers nor besieged had yet fired a shot. Röhm and his men were all ex-soldiers, and they had many wartime comrades on the other side of the barbed wire. Neither side had any heart for killing. To reach the War Ministry and free Röhm, Hitler and Ludendorff now led their column through the narrow Residenzstrasse, which, just beyond the Feldherrnhalle, opens out into the spacious Odeonsplatz. At the end of the gully-like street, a detachment of police about 100 strong, armed with carbines, blocked the way. They were in a strategic spot, and this time they did not give way. But once again the Nazis tried to talk their way through. One of them, the faithful bodyguard Ulrich Graf, stepped forward and cried out to the police officer in charge, "Don't shoot! His Excellency Ludendorff is coming!" Even at this crucial, perilous moment, a German revolutionary, even an old amateur wrestler and professional bouncer, remembered to give a gentleman his proper title. Hitler added another cry. "Surrender! Surrender!" he called out. But the unknown police officer did not surrender. Apparently, Ludendorff's name had no magic sound for him. This was the police, not the army. Which side fired first was never established. Each put the blame on the other. One onlooker later testified that Hitler fired the first shot with his revolver. Another thought that Streicher did, and more than one Nazi later told this author that it was this deed which, more than any other, endeared him so long to Hitler. Some years later, in approving Streicher's appointment as Nazi leader for Franconia over the opposition of many party comrades, Hitler declared, "Perhaps there are one or two who don't like the shape of Comrade Streicher's nose. But when he lay beside me that day on the pavement by the Feldherrnhalle, I vowed to myself never to forsake him so long as he did not forsake me." Haydn, Hitler, A Biography, page 157. At any rate, a shot was fired, and in the next instant a volley of shots rang out from both sides, spelling in that instant the doom of Hitler's hopes. Scheubner-Richter fell, mortally wounded. Göring went down with a serious wound in his thigh. Within 60 seconds the firing stopped, but the street was already littered with fallen bodies, 16 Nazis and 3 police dead or dying, many more wounded, and the rest, including Hitler, clutching the pavement to save their lives. There was one exception, and had his example been followed, the day might have had a different ending. Ludendorff did not fling himself to the ground. Standing erect and proud in the best soldierly tradition, with his adjutant, Major Streck, at his side, he marched calmly on between the muzzles of the police rifles until he reached the Odeonsplatz. He must have seemed a lonely and bizarre figure. Not one Nazi followed him, not even the supreme leader, Adolf Hitler. The future Chancellor of the Third Reich was the first to scamper to safety. He had locked his left arm with the right arm of Scheudner Richter, a curious but perhaps revealing gesture, as the column approached the police cordon, and when the latter fell, he pulled Hitler down to the pavement with him. Perhaps Hitler thought he had been wounded. He suffered sharp pains, which, it was found later, came from a dislocated shoulder. But the fact remains that according to the testimony of one of his own Nazi followers in the column, the physician Dr. Walter Schulz, which was supported by several other witnesses, Hitler was the first to get up and turn back, leaving his dead and wounded comrades lying in the street. He was hustled into a waiting motor car and spirited off to the country home of the Hanfstaengls at Uffing, where Putzi's wife and sister nursed him and where, 2 days later, he was arrested. Ludendorff was arrested on the spot. He was contemptuous of the rebels who had not had the courage to march on with him, and so bitter against the army for not coming over to his side that he declared henceforth he would not recognize a German officer, nor ever again wear an officer's uniform. The wounded Goering was given first aid by the Jewish proprietor of a nearby bank into which he had been carried, and then smuggled across the frontier into Austria by his wife and taken to a hospital in Innsbruck. Hess also fled to Austria. Röhm surrendered at the war ministry 2 hours after the collapse before the Feldherrnhalle. Within a few days, all the rebel leaders except Goering and Hess were rounded up and jailed. The Nazi putsch had ended in a fiasco. The party was dissolved. National Socialism, to all appearances, was dead. Its dictatorial leader, who had run away at the first hail of bullets, seemed utterly discredited, his meteoric political career at an end. Trial for treason. As things turned out, that career was merely interrupted, and not for long. Hitler was shrewd enough to see that his trial, far from finishing him, would provide a new platform from which he could not only discredit the compromised authorities who had arrested him, but, and this was more important, for the first time make his name known far beyond the confines of Bavaria, and indeed of Germany itself. He was well aware that correspondents of the world press, as well as of the leading German newspapers, were flocking to Munich to cover the trial, which began on February 26, 1924, before a special court sitting in the old infantry school in the Blutenbergstrasse. By the time it had ended 24 days later, Hitler had transformed defeat into triumph, made Kahr, Lossow, and Zeisser share his guilt in the public mind to their ruin, impressed the German people with his eloquence and the fervor of his nationalism, and emblazoned his name on the front pages of the world. Although Ludendorff was easily the most famous of the 10 prisoners in the dock, Hitler at once grabbed the limelight for himself. From beginning to end, he dominated the courtroom. Franz Gürtner, the Bavarian minister of justice and an old friend and protector of the Nazi leader, had seen to it that the judiciary would be complacent and lenient. Hitler was allowed to interrupt as often as he pleased, cross-examine witnesses at will, and speak on his own behalf at any time and at any length. His opening statement consumed 4 hours, but it was only the first of many long harangues. He did not intend to make the mistake of those who, when tried for complicity in the Kapp-Putsch, had pleaded, as he later said, that they knew nothing, had intended nothing, wished nothing. That was what destroyed the bourgeois world. That they had not the courage to stand by their act, to step before the judge and say, yes, that was what we wanted to do, we wanted to destroy the state. Now, before the judges and the representatives of the world press in Munich, Hitler proclaimed proudly, I alone bear the responsibility, but I am not a criminal because of that. If today I stand here as a revolutionary, it is as a revolutionary against the revolution. There is no such thing as high treason against the traitors of 1918. If there were, then the three men who headed the government, the army, and the police in Bavaria, and who had conspired with him against the national government, were equally guilty and should be in the dock beside him instead of in the witness stand as his chief accusers. Shrewdly, he turned the tables on the uneasy, guilt-ridden triumvirs. One thing was certain. Lossow, Kahr, and Zeisser had the same goal that we had, to get rid of the Reich government. If our enterprise was actually high treason, then during the whole period Lossow, Kahr, and Zeisser must have been committing high treason along with us, for during all these weeks we talked of nothing but the aims of which we now stand accused. The three men could scarcely deny this, for it was true. Kahr and Zeisser were no match for Hitler's barbs. Only General von Lossow defended himself defiantly. "I was no unemployed komitadji," he reminded the court. "I occupied a high position in the state." And the general poured all the scorn of an old army officer on his former corporal, this unemployed upstart, whose overpowering ambition had led him to try to dictate to the army and the state. How far this unscrupulous demagogue had come, he exclaimed, from the days not so far distant when he had been willing to be merely the drummer in a patriotic movement. "A drummer, merely?" Hitler knew how to answer that. "How petty are the thoughts of small men. Believe me, I do not regard the acquisition of a minister's portfolio as a thing worth striving for. I do not hold it worthy of a great man to endeavor to go down in history just by becoming a minister. One might be in danger of being buried beside other ministers. My aim from the first was 1,000 times higher than becoming a minister. I wanted to become the destroyer of Marxism. I am going to achieve this task, and if I do, the title of minister will be an absurdity so far as I am concerned." He invoked the example of Wagner. "When I stood for the first time at the grave of Richard Wagner, my heart overflowed with pride in a man who had forbidden any such inscription as, 'Here lies Privy Councillor, Music Director, His Excellency Baron Richard von Wagner.' I was proud that this man and so many others in German history were content to give their names to history without titles. It was not from modesty that I wanted to be a drummer in those days. That was the highest aspiration. The rest is nothing." He had been accused of wanting to jump from drummer to dictator. He would not deny it. Fate had decreed it. "The man who is born to be a dictator is not compelled. He wills it. He is not driven forward, but drives himself. There is nothing immodest about this. Is it immodest for a worker to drive himself toward heavy labor? Is it presumptuous of a man with the high forehead of a thinker to ponder through the nights till he gives the world an invention? The man who feels called upon to govern a people has no right to say, 'If you want me or summon me, I will cooperate.' No, it is his duty to step forward. Though he might be in the dock facing a long prison sentence for high treason against his country, his confidence in himself, in the call to govern a people, was undiminished. While in prison awaiting trial, he had already analyzed the reasons for the failure of the putsch and had vowed that he would not commit the same mistakes in the future. Recalling his thoughts 13 years later, after he had achieved his goal, he told his old followers, assembled at the Bürgerbräukeller to celebrate the anniversary of the putsch, "I can calmly say that it was the rashest decision of my life. When I think back on it today, I grow dizzy. If today you saw one of our squads from the year 1923 marching by, you would ask, 'What workhouse have they escaped from?' But fate meant well with us. It did not permit an action to succeed which, if it had succeeded, would in the end have inevitably crashed as a result of the movement's inner immaturity in those days and its deficient organizational and intellectual foundation. We recognize that it is not enough to overthrow the old state, but that the new state must previously have been built up and be ready to one's hand. In 1933 it was no longer a question of overthrowing a state by an act of violence. Meanwhile the new state had been built up, and all that remained to do was to destroy the last remnants of the old state, and that took but a few hours." How to build the new Nazi state was already in his mind as he fenced with the judges and his prosecutors during the trial. For one thing, he would have to have the German army with him, not against him, the next time. In his closing address, he played on the idea of reconciliation with the armed forces. There was no word of reproach for the army. "I believe that the hour will come when the masses, who today stand in the street with our swastika banner, will unite with those who fired upon them. When I learned that it was the Green Police which fired, I was happy that it was not the Reichswehr which had stained the record. The Reichswehr stands as untarnished as before. One day the hour will come when the Reichswehr will stand at our side, officers and men." It was an accurate prediction, but here the presiding judge intervened. "Herr Hitler, you say that the Green Police was stained. That I cannot permit." The accused paid not the slightest attention to the admonition. In a peroration that held the audience in the courtroom spellbound, Hitler spoke his final words. The army we have formed is growing from day to day. I nourish the proud hope that one day the hour will come when these rough companies will grow to battalions, the battalions to regiments, the regiments to divisions, that the old cockade will be taken from the mud, that the old flags will wave again, that there will be a reconciliation at the last great divine judgment which we are prepared to face. He turned his burning eyes directly on the judges. For it is not you, gentlemen, who pass judgment on us. That judgment is spoken by the eternal court of history. What judgment you will hand down, I know. But that court will not ask us, did you commit high treason or did you not? That court will judge us, the quartermaster general of the old army, Ludendorff, his officers and soldiers, as Germans who wanted only the good of their own people and fatherland, who wanted to fight and die. You may pronounce us guilty 1,000 times over, but the goddess of the eternal court of history will smile and tear to tatters the brief of the state prosecutor and the sentence of this court. For she acquits us. The sentences, if not the verdicts of the actual judges, were, as Conrad Haydn wrote, not so far from the judgment of history. Ludendorff was acquitted. Hitler and the other accused were found guilty. But in the face of the law, Article 81 of the German Penal Code, which declared that whosoever attempts to alter by force the constitution of the German Reich or of any German state shall be punished by lifelong imprisonment, Hitler was sentenced to 5 years' imprisonment in the old fortress of Landsberg. Even then the lay judges protested the severity of the sentence, but they were assured by the presiding judge that the prisoner would be eligible for parole after he had served 6 months. Efforts of the police to get Hitler deported as a foreigner, he still held Austrian citizenship, came to nothing. The sentences were imposed on April 1, 1924. A little less than 9 months later, on December 20th, Hitler was released from prison, free to resume his fight to overthrow the democratic state. The consequences of committing high treason, if you were a man of the extreme right, were not unduly heavy, despite the law, and a good many anti-Republicans took notice of it. The putsch, even though it was a fiasco, made Hitler a national figure, and, in the eyes of many, a patriot and a hero. Nazi propaganda soon transformed it into one of the great legends of the movement. Each year, even after he came to power, even after World War II broke out, Hitler returned on the evening of November 8th to the beer hall in Munich to address his old guard comrades, the Alte Kämpfer, as they were called, who had followed the leader to what seemed then such a grotesque disaster. In 1935, Hitler, the Chancellor, had the bodies of the 16 Nazis who had fallen in the brief encounter dug up and placed in vaults in the Feldherrnhalle, which became a national shrine. Of them, Hitler said, in dedicating the memorial, "They now pass into German immortality. Here they stand for Germany and keep guard over our people. Here they lie as true witnesses to our movement." He did not add, and no German seemed to recall, that they were also the men whom Hitler had abandoned to their dying when he had picked himself up from the pavement and ran away. That summer of 1924 in the old fortress at Landsberg, high above the River Lech, Adolf Hitler, who was treated as an honored guest with a room of his own and a splendid view, cleared out the visitors who flocked to pay him homage and bring him gifts, summoned the faithful Rudolf Hess, who had finally returned to Munich and received a sentence, and began to dictate to him chapter after chapter of a book. Before the arrival of Hess, Emil Maurice, an ex-convict, a watchmaker and the first commander of the Nazi strong-arm squads, took some preliminary dictation.